Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If saving more and spending less is one of your top goals for 2023, why are you still paying insane amounts of money every month for your phone bill? Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile, you'll get their unlimited plan for 50% off. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Hurry. Offer ends January 15th.
Today, running your small or mid-sized business is challenging to say the least. There is greater pressure to offer a flexible and safe work environment. At HP, we get that. We design our products to support the needs of both the traditional office space and your employees' hybrid environment. We create IT solutions that help run your small or mid-sized business no matter where your employees are. Whether you have 5 employees or 500, HP can help. Call our U.S.-based small business advisor team today at 1-800-608-MYHP or click below.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 22nd of January, these are our main stories. Tens of thousands take to the streets of Tel Aviv. They're angry about what they say are anti-democratic moves by Israel's new government. Germany's coming under further pressure to provide tanks to Ukraine. President Lula da Silva of Brazil has sacked the chief of the army 2 weeks after the assault on government buildings by rioters calling for a coup. Also in this podcast...
How many do you sell a day?
Between 400 and 500. We are a small bakery.
Which is in a little street beneath the hill of Montmartre.
So why are baguettes, France's distinctive long loaves of bread, such an important part of French life? Let's begin in Tel Aviv, where on Saturday, tens of thousands of demonstrators gathered after the Sabbath to protest against plans by Israel's right-wing government to limit the power of the judiciary. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition has been accused of attacking democracy with its intention to overhaul Israel's Supreme Court. The government wants to tighten control over judicial appointments because of what it describes as activist judges. The former Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid was at the demonstration.
What you see here today is a demonstration in support of the country. This is a demonstration for Israel. People who love the country have come here today to defend its democracy, to defend its courts, to defend the idea of coexistence and of common good. There are people here who love Israel, who came to demonstrate for a democratic Jewish state, and we will not give up until we win.
Mr. Netanyahu dismissed the protests, now in their third week, as a refusal by his rivals to accept the results of last November's election. Our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman spent the evening in Tel Aviv.
Well, these protesters say they believe there is a coup going on to try and dismantle Israel's system of government by Mr. Netanyahu, by this new coalition. It is the most radically nationalist, right-wing and religious government in Israel's history, and it has brought all these people out onto the streets of Tel Aviv tonight. I was just chatting to one woman who was here with a baby son who said that she was so concerned about the direction of the country that she was considering leaving it and that she didn't want her son to serve in the army. And for something like that, for Israelis, that is a profound point. And the reason they're all out here is that coalition being into its third week. They've talked about their belief that Benjamin Netanyahu wants to water down the independence of the courts. They see that as an attack on Israeli democracy. Now, Mr. Netanyahu himself has been dismissive throughout of these protests. He says that they are effectively denying the will of the people and says that there was a much bigger demonstration. That was the election that took place in November and led to the formation of his coalition. Now, the police tonight are estimating numbers that were greater than last week, when they said there are at least 80,000 people protesting. That would make this certainly the biggest anti-government demonstration in Israel in recent years.
Our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman in Tel Aviv. Another protest with tens of thousands of people in Spain, with a rally in the heart of Madrid against the left-wing government of Pedro Sanchez. Activists and politicians from the far-right Vox party and two centre-right parties accused the administration of undemocratic behaviour and of encouraging Catalan and Basque separatists. Here's Guy Hedgeco.
This demonstration was organised by right-wing civic organisations, and the far-right Vox party was a prominent presence. The Prime Minister's willingness to engage with the pro-independence regional government in Catalonia has angered Vox and others on the right. They're particularly furious at his recent reform of the criminal code, which is seen as benefiting some Catalan independence leaders. The government described the demonstrators as radicals who want to undermine peaceful coexistence among Spaniards.
Next to Ukraine, Berlin is coming under further pressure to allow the export of German-made battle tanks. Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania issued a joint statement after Germany refused to say whether it would provide any of its own highly regarded Leopard 2 tanks or allow other countries to do so. A senior advisor to President Zelensky has warned that each day of delay means the death of more Ukrainians. Here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
This row is fast becoming a litmus test for just how far the West will go to support its beleaguered ally and neighbour, Ukraine. The Ukrainian government, the Baltic states, Poland, Britain and even many in Germany are baffled and frustrated by the German government's hesitation to release the Leopard 2 tanks that Kyiv so desperately needs. More than 2,000 of them are sitting in warehouses across Europe, and they're widely judged to be the most suitable weapon to both blunt Russia's coming spring offensive and enable Ukraine to retake territory. An advisor to Ukraine's defence minister, Yuri Sak, said Ukraine urgently needed the means to push Russia out of the land it's taken.
We are very grateful to our allies for the military support that we have received so far. But of course, right now, for us to be able to defend our land means to be able to deoccupy our land, to liberate our territories. And for this, we need heavy tanks. For this, we need armored vehicles.
So what's holding Germany back? Well, there is history, of course. The last time German tanks went into battle in Ukraine, it was part of Hitler's ill-fated wartime invasion of the Soviet Union. Since then, Germany has tried hard to be a pacifist nation. But there's also a deep-rooted fear of escalation, of provoking President Putin. Germany says it will release its tanks, but only as part of a broad multinational package, and that, we are told, could take up to a month to reach a decision on.
So where does public opinion in Germany stand at the moment on the supply of tanks to Ukraine? Julian Marshall spoke to Claudia Meyer from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin.
There has been a change in the public opinion. Until recently, there was a majority against the delivery of main battle tanks, but recent polls from the last day show that there's now a majority supporting the delivery of Leopard tanks. So there has been a change in favour.
And what accounts for those divided opinions?
I think there is still a deep unease about all things military in Germany. There's a big support for Ukraine, but there's still a big unease about military means and recognizing that you need a military victory before you can move on to a real diplomatic solution. And that's an historical legacy, Germany not feeling at ease with all things military.
So there is a deep-rooted pacifism, you are saying?
I think it's a bit more complex. Pacifism as an individual preference is something that is respectable and honourable. But if pacifism turns into a policy of a state where you don't take positions, even if the situation between victim and aggressor is totally crystal clear, it becomes unethical. So you can be a pacifist as an individual, but not as a state in such a clear situation.
Are there not historical reasons for that aversion or contemporary aversion in Germany towards military action?
Yes, I mean, there's still a deep belief that Germany learned the lessons from the past, and we learned the lesson that military brings horrible suffering, it doesn't solve conflicts, and that we should use it in a very limited and special way. There's also the belief that we should always prefer diplomatic solutions. It worked for us for the German unification. It went peacefully. So there's a conviction that diplomatic solutions should always be the first option and that they work.
But there must also be a generation of Germans who remember German tanks rushing across to Ukraine and indeed Russia on behalf of Nazi Germany.
It's actually interesting because on the one hand, this generation takes this experience as a reason to not engage with military means. But if you look at the recent polls, we see that particularly in the 65-plus group, many people support the delivery of main battle tanks, exactly because they know what happened in the Second World War and it shouldn't be repeated by the Russians against Ukraine. So I think there is a little bit, the opinion is evolving here. But we also have to recognize that you don't change the defense identity of a country in 1 year or 2 years. Germany changed a lot since the war started last year. Germany is doing things that it never did in the past, like delivering weapons to a war country. In a certain extent, what Germany did in the defense policy since February 2022 is revolutionary. Spending more on defense, sending weapons to Ukraine, something that was unbelievable before. So it's amazing what Germany did, but compared what we should do in support of Ukraine and in front of the challenges ahead, it's still too little. So there's a certain tragedy, and Germany did so much, but it's still too little.
Claudia Meyer, who's a security analyst in Berlin. President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of Brazil has fired the country's army commander just 2 weeks after the violent invasion of government buildings in the capital by supporters of the former president, Jair Bolsonaro. President Lula da Silva said he suspected that members of the military and the police colluded with the rioters, who claimed, despite there being no evidence, that last October's presidential election was rigged. I spoke to our Latin America regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, and asked him about the military chief who'd only just been appointed.
General Arruda, who left, he was close to the former president, President Bolsonaro. We don't know yet why he's been sacked. But what the Brazilian media are saying is that President Lula asked him to sack a colonel that was very close to President Bolsonaro, who was involved in allegations of corruption, and he refused to sack him and instead promoted that person. So there was a meeting with the high command of the military and President Lula on Friday, and I think that his fate was decided there. He's replaced by General Ribeiro Paiva, who is someone who worked with the Workers' Party government before, who was in a peace mission in Haiti. Earlier this week, he made a public speech saying that the armed forces shouldn't get involved in politics and they should support democracy and accept the results of the elections.
So President Lula da Silva is asserting his authority here. Does this carry risks, though, the idea of presidents telling the army who to promote and who to fire?
I don't think so at this stage. I think that Lula has been very careful. This storming of the public buildings, Congress and the presidential palace, happened 2 weeks ago. He has quietly dismissed about 50 people with high posts, not generals, but people who had positions of power in the government, military people. And I think the tone of what's happening has been given by the defense minister, who said on Friday, it's time to turn the page and we have to look forward to the future. And he said individuals might have got involved in these acts of vandalism, in these riots, but not the institution, not the armed forces.
Leonardo Rocha reporting. Let's go to the West African state of Niger now, where the number of women who die after giving birth is being reduced. And the lessons learned in Niger can apply elsewhere too. Africa regional editor Will Ross has been telling me more about an initiative which focused on mothers who die due to blood loss.
The research has gone on over the last 6 years, so it's not something that's just happened quickly and is a sort of sign of some success. They're saying there's sustained success over these 6 years, basically more than halving the number of women who died as a result of blood loss after giving birth. That's the headline, but also 90% fewer women experienced excessive bleeding compared with the typical numbers that Niger was showing before. And worth saying that, you know, this is an extremely poor country with very, very basic health facilities across the country. So the goal was to try and use this research, working with the Ministry of Health, and this NGO called Health and Development Initiative to really try and make an impact right across the country for a huge problem that's been there for some years.
What treatments did they use that were so successful?
Well, what they called it was a three-step initiative. So for starters, there was giving to all pregnant women a tablet which contracts the uterus. It's called misoprostol, and that is a tablet that should reduce the bleeding. So many mothers in Niger give birth at home. So one problem was to try and address that and get them into the health centres. But they were given that tablet and told, when you come to give birth at the clinic, bring the tablet with you. If you haven't managed to make it to the clinic, then as soon as you've given birth, you take this tablet immediately. Then the second step was, if after 20 minutes the bleeding hadn't stopped, then a condom attached to a catheter is then inserted by a health practitioner into the uterus, and it's inflated, and that aims to stop the bleeding. And if that doesn't work, then there's something called a non-inflatable anti-shock garment, which I've certainly never heard of, but it looks a little bit like the sort of bottom half of a wetsuit cut into pieces that is then wrapped around the mother with the aim of stopping the bleeding. And then obviously surgery can take place as well if necessary.
And this presumably could be applied to other low-income countries in Africa and around the world.
That's the real big news on this, the scaling up possibilities. Dr. Zaidu Alassoum, who's the Health and Development Initiative resident advisor in Niger, talked about the method achieving rapid reductions in maternal bleeding deaths, and he said it could prevent millions more women around the world from bleeding to death after they give birth. So a lot of optimism, I mean, partly because I think the cost of it is relatively low. This is not something that is out of reach, even for countries that don't have huge health budgets.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross. Still to come. In China, children sing, dressed up as rabbits, as the Lunar New Year begins. As we heard in Saturday's podcast, this weekend marks the 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, when the US Supreme Court established a constitutional right to abortion, the right that got struck down 7 months ago. Anti-abortion activists celebrated at their annual march in Washington, but on both sides of the bitter divide over this issue, the battle is far from over. From Washington, our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher reports.
These marches have taken place every year since Roe v. Wade was passed, demanding that it be overturned. And now it has been. So this time it's different. There's a lot of celebration.
A lot of people are ear-to-ear smiling. I think the spirit is, like, celebrating. This is just the beginning.
How do you feel on this weekend, which would have been the 50th anniversary of the passing of Roe v. Wade?
I'm so thankful that I live to see the day.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions.
That decision 50 years ago now bitterly divides this country, but it was a life-changing moment for a generation of women.
I would be in the OR room holding the patient's hand, and then I'm getting a little teary, I'm sorry.
Mona Reese is a longtime activist who began work as a counselor at an abortion clinic the very next day, and eventually founded her own.
It was just so impacting to me to see such a profound sense of relief that the patients knew this was behind them.
Did you ever think 50 years ago that you would be in this position now?
No, never.
In the months since then, abortion access has come to depend on your address. A dozen states governed by Republicans have banned the procedure.
So we've definitely seen the most increased need for travel support. So
Melissa Fowler works for the Professional Association of Abortion Providers. It has stepped up support to help women cross state lines. But that's not always the answer.
Travel is just not possible for everyone. Finances aren't the only barrier. Some people don't have child care or can't get the time off work. We've talked to people who maybe haven't told anyone else, even in their family, about their decision to have an abortion.
There is uncertainty even for those who are claiming victory, like Carol Tobias, president of the National Right to Life Committee.
We don't know what's going to happen in some of these states. It's kind of not a free-for-all, but there's just a lot of unknowns.
The movement is reorienting, looking for tighter state restrictions on abortion, but also more public spending to help families cope with unplanned pregnancies.
My goal is to make abortion unthinkable so that even if abortion is legal, no woman wants one. And we're going to do what we can to change their hearts and minds so that they protect life and help women.
And in that battle today, where do you feel you are?
Right in the middle.
Barbara Platosha in Washington. Now to a big celebration. Children dressed up as rabbits singing on China's Spring Festival TV gala as the Lunar New Year begins. It is the Year of the Rabbit and the first Spring Festival in China in 4 years without any COVID travel restrictions. That means tens of millions of people are on the move. This woman at a railway station in Hong Kong was reunited with her family members who'd come from Shenzhen.
I'm very happy to see my son and his family. This is our first reunion in 3 years. I want to enjoy meals together.
So as China's leader Xi Jinping promises glories and dreams, what will that movement of so many people mean for COVID with cases surging across the country? I asked our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow.
Because China is an enormous country, the numbers are enormous too. So over the course of the New Year holiday period, we expect about 2 billion individual journeys to take place across China. That means every day there's going to be tens of millions of people on the move. Saturday, it's the final day before the new year, Year of the Rabbit. So, of course, train stations, airports have been jam-packed. More people than last year because, of course, COVID restrictions have been released in China now, so more people are on the move, but still fewer people are travelling than before the pandemic began.
So the pandemic looms large behind this. First of all, people's desire to go and see family and friends is particularly strong because they've not been able to. But yet we have this resurgence in COVID cases going on.
You can see this with interviews with Chinese people on trains at airports. They're being asked, are you looking forward to going home? Yes, we haven't been home for 2 or 3 years, taking the kids to see grandma and granddad, that kind of thing. But we're very worried that we're going to take COVID back with us. And that's the fear among many medical experts, that at the moment, China's going through a COVID crisis. Tens of thousands of people have died. We're not sure exactly how many because the government hasn't told us. But the fear is that is going to get worse.
The symbol of the rabbit has been present everywhere in China for weeks now. For Chinese people, it's the Lunar New Year of the rabbit. But other parts of the world have different animals?
Yes, it's the Lunar New Year, so many people in East Asia celebrate it. Koreans, Chinese, Vietnamese people, and it's in Vietnam where they don't celebrate the Year of the Rabbit, it's the Year of the Cat. Now, it's difficult to work out exactly why the animal has been changed. In fact, years ago in Vietnam, they used to have the rabbit, now it's the cat. There's some suggestions there's a linguistic reason for this in the translation from Chinese to Vietnamese. And also there's in mythology, an idea that animals started on a race to become the 12 animals which would form the zodiac. In the Chinese version, the cat didn't get to the end, so didn't become one of the animals. In the Vietnamese version, the cat got there in time and is in the fourth animal in the zodiac. So not quite sure where the legend comes from, but there is that difference.
Michael Bristow reporting. Now, to a story of a real-life guardian angel. Hody Childress donated thousands of dollars to his local pharmacy in the US state of Alabama, so people who couldn't afford to pay for their medication could still get it. The story from Andrew Cheng.
Hody Childress spent his whole life in Geraldine, Alabama, working as a farmer and an employee of nearby Lockheed Martin Space Facility. His family described him as a wise, humble, God-loving man who would often send handwritten get-well cards and share vegetables from his garden with neighbors. But even his family didn't know one big secret. Every month, Mr. Childress donated $100 to the local pharmacy for anyone who couldn't afford to pay for a prescription. It all started nearly 10 years ago when he approached the pharmacist, Brooke Walker.
He pulled me to the side and he said, do you ever have anybody that can't pay for their medication? Hmm. And I'm like, you know, unfortunately, yeah, that happens a good bit. And so he handed me a bill that I couldn't tell what it was at the time. It was folded up. He said, next time that happens, will you use this and don't tell where it came from and don't tell me who you used it on and just tell them that it's a blessing from the Lord.
Over the years, he gave nearly $12,000 to the community. Eventually, his daughter, Tanya Nix, had to be brought in on the secret. After battling illness for years, her father became unable to leave his home, so someone else had to deliver the money.
And he just said, I want you to take a $100 bill up to the drugstore at the first of the month, as long as I'm alive. And I said, okay.
Mr. Childress died on the 1st of January this year. He was 80 years old. At his funeral, his daughter felt compelled to speak about his generosity because it showed what kind of man he was. Some of those who believe they may have benefited have thanked the family, and the pharmacist, Miss Walker, says his giving has inspired other people.
We've had calls of people wanting to keep his fund going,
yeah,
and, you know, wanting to send us a check to put on his fund. So, and people in the community are doing the same thing. So I see the fund lasting for a long time.
His daughter says his father's gesture has been a reminder of the importance of kindness and community.
Andrew Cheng reporting. Baguettes, France's distinctive long loaves of bread, recently won UNESCO heritage status. So what exactly makes this intangible cultural heritage, as the UN agency puts it, such an important part of everyday life in France? Has been for more than 200 years. From Paris, our reporter John Lawrenson.
A baker named Sébastien Ayertz needs the dough for a batch of baguettes. How many do you sell a day?
Between 400 and 500. We are a small bakery.
Which is in a little street beneath the hill of Montmartre and the white domes of Sacré-Cœur Church that sits on top of it. There are 33,513 bakers' shops like this in France that are allowed to call themselves boulangerie because they make their own bread. 70% of the bread people buy is baguette. These customers explain why.
La texture.
It's the texture. Crusty on the outside, soft inside.
Bah, je l'achète,
pour... I buy one for breakfast. In fact, I can't conceive of a meal without there being at least a little bread. And the pleasure of going to buy a baguette is an important moment of conviviality in my day.
For visitors and locals alike, the baguette is part of the French way of life. Though not a lot of people know that it was Napoleon who imposed the baguette's superb shape, long and thin, unlike the emperor. It was easier to carry in pockets at the back of soldiers' coats, quicker to bake in camp ovens when the Grande Armée was on the move. Sébastien Ayertz pulls a rack of golden baguettes out of the oven. This is a French basic, like liberty, equality, fraternity. Pain for the people.
There is definitely a social aspect with the baguette, because everybody eats baguette. It's for everyone. All the people together around the baguette.
Elle est à toi cette chanson. Toi l'hôtesse qui sans façon m'a donné quatre bouts de pain quand dans ma vie il faisait faim.
One of the most famous songs by legend of chanson Georges Brassens about small acts of charity like giving bread to a hungry person. In the years leading up to the French Revolution, 98% of people's calorie intake came from bread. When it went lacking, they starved. Lack of bread sent the mob to the Palace of Versailles, where it found large stocks of it, brought it back to Paris along with the King and Queen, escorted by revolutionary guards with loaves stuck to the end of their bayonets. One of the first measures taken by the New Republic was to legislate on bread standards. Everyone would eat the same bread. Le pain d'égalité, they called it. Equality bread.
Elle est à toi, cette chanson.
John Lawrenson reporting from Paris. And that's all from us for now. There will be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Or you can find us on Twitter, where we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Season 3 of My Indian Life,
The podcast that explores the lives of young adults living in 21st century India is available to binge in full now. It's sometimes raw.
So many of our elders were denied the opportunity, even though they are deserving, just because of their caste, just because of where they come from.
Often uplifting.
Because of you, we didn't give up, and I'm not giving up. Even if one person is inspired, that is the real success for me.
And always compelling.
We are evicted from that place. Our land is taken away. Our forest, we are not able to access it.
That's Kalki Presents My Indian Life from the BBC World Service. Just search for My Indian Life wherever you found this podcast.
Today, running your small or mid-sized business is challenging to say the least. There is greater pressure to offer a flexible and safe work environment. At HP, we get that. We design our products to support the needs of both the traditional office space and your employees' hybrid environment. We create IT solutions that help run your small or mid-sized business no matter where your employees are. Whether you have 5 employees or 500, HP can help. Call our U.S.-based small business advisor team today at 1-800-608-MYHP or click below.